Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Lisha Sequist, and to begin, she presented a patient from her practice.
This patient was a young woman, and a lot of the patients that we see for clinical trials, unfortunately, are some of the youngest and saddest cases, you know, people traveling to the far ends of the earth to try and find something to help. She was only about 41 or 42 when she was diagnosed with advanced stage 4 lung adenocarcinoma. She was a healthy, athletic mother of four who worked in a school and was having trouble breathing. So after some workup, she was found to have bilateral pulmonary nodules, as well as an adrenal metastasis. She had a biopsy which confirmed that this was lung cancer, adenocarcinoma, and genetic testing was done right away before any treatment, which did reveal the exon 19 EGFR mutation. So she was placed on first-line erlotinib and initially did very well. She had a quick response, her breathing improved, and this was maintained for about 10 months. But then her breathing started to get a little worse again, a little bit of a cough. Her oncologist recommended then that she try afatinib, and I believe she took that for about 2 months with no response.
Could I just pick up on that point? Because, you know, we have a very astute audience of medical oncologists who goes to our meetings, listens to our stuff, etc. But we consistently find that there's a substantial minority, maybe 15-20% of docs, who do what this patient had done, which is to use afatinib after erlotinib. Is that something that you think is evidence-based?
No, it's not evidence-based, but I agree with you. It is more common than I wish it were. I think people think that it's a newer drug, so it must be used after the older drug. But in reality, what the data points us towards is that afatinib can be a really good EGFR inhibitor, but its place is in the first-line setting. So you have a patient who's never received an EGFR treatment, you have the option of choosing between erlotinib and afatinib, but once they've been on one of them and are starting to progress through it, I don't think you would gain too much activity by transitioning from one to the other in either direction. But afatinib has been specifically studied in this case. It was studied in a randomized trial called LUX-Lung-1, and it was for patients who had previously received both chemotherapy and a first-generation EGFR inhibitor, so either erlotinib or gefitinib. And these patients were randomized to afatinib or placebo in the third line. And there was no benefit from that study. The primary endpoint was overall survival. There was no survival benefit against placebo. And even the response rate to the afatinib arm was in the single digit. It was 7%, I believe. So this isn't a very active drug in resistance.
Right. And before you go on with this case, just another thing that, I don't know, maybe it's sort of becoming a footnote, you know, maybe a year or two ago, there would have been a lot of interest in at least talking about the possibility of afatinib and cetuximab, and it kind of seems like people are less interested in that as now as the third generation agents have come on board. Is that a combination nowadays that you would ever use? Is it still being studied?
I would use it in the right situation, and I think you're right. It does have a track record of activity. Afatinib alone does not have a track record of activity in resistance, but combined with cetuximab, monoclonal antibody to EGFR, there's a consistent 30% response rate that's been seen in a couple different populations. So I think it is an option. I think the reason why people are voting with their feet towards some of the newer clinical trial drugs is that the combo of afatinib cetuximab can have a pretty good amount of dermatologic toxicity. It can be pretty brutal.
Is that combination being studied right now?
It's going to be led by the SWOG group, and my understanding is that it's a first-line study for EGFR mutation patients, and they're randomized to either single-agent afatinib or the combo afatinib-cetuximab. With, you know, I think the hypothesis is that you start with the combo right away, maybe you can get a longer progression-free survival than just starting with the one drug.
So one other question before you go on with this case, kind of going back to the beginning, the fact that she had a exon 19 EGFR mutation, what have we learned about sort of the differential response based on the type of mutation, particularly this one, the L858 one? I saw a paper that just came out in JAMA Oncology, I think it's a new journal, looking at erlotinib, and we had previously seen some data, I guess about a year ago, with afatinib. What's the message coming through here in terms of sort of differential response?
Yeah, it's a really interesting area that I think we're still learning about. So For the last 10 years, I think EGFR mutations have kind of been thought of in all of our minds as one thing. Yes, there are different subtypes, but generally we're talking about kind of a bucket diagnosis. And now I think with more patients on more trials and really being able to dissect the data, it looks like we may see some differences in the way that different mutations respond to different drugs. The two most common EGFR mutations are exon 19 deletion and L858R. Together, that's 90% of the patients. So, I mean, I think for practical terms for an oncologist, those are the only two that you really need to kind of have in your mind what the data says. But what the data shows so far is that some drugs, there doesn't seem to be a great difference in the outcomes, whether it's deletion 19 or L858R. And some drugs, there may be a difference. And specifically, afatinib is the one that looks like maybe it's a little better in exon 19 compared to how it performs in L858R, whereas erlotinib seems to be a little bit more equivalent in how it performs.
You mentioned those two mutations and like the early data there, but there is another one we've heard about. I think it's the 20 that doesn't really respond to the TKIs and you have to go with chemo?
Yeah, so exon 20 insertion mutations, again, like the 19 deletions, there can be different individual deletions and they kind of get glommed together as just a deletion in general. And the same is true with the insertions in exon 20. There's more than one individual insertion, but we tend to think of them together. It actually makes up a significant, you know, of the 10% that aren't L858R and exon 19, most of them are actually exon 20, so it's the third most common type. And the way that that mutation changes the EGFR protein, it doesn't bind to any of the TKIs, at least any of the ones that we have available now. So in general, if you find an exon 20 insertion mutation in EGFR in your patient, you should not be reaching for erlotinib or afatinib. Chemo is probably a more appropriate option at this time.
So going back to this lady who seems to be going down a pretty familiar course, having an initial response to erlotinib, progresses right through afatinib, then next step, chemo.
Yeah, so then she was started on chemotherapy with carboplatin and pemetrexed, and she did have stabilization for a few months, but unfortunately after about 4 months, cough came back again, and that's when she came to see me in consultation, and we recommended a biopsy. You know, if I'd seen her earlier, I probably would have gotten the biopsy as soon as she was progressing on her erlotinib, but nevertheless, we did a biopsy then, and we saw the T790 resistance mutation, which we see in about 50 to 60% of people who get resistant to erlotinib.
So again, this lady's going down a path that is pretty familiar, but starting to change a little bit. And I'm just kind of curious, before you talk about what happened to her with the T790 mutation, what would you have done if there wasn't a T790 mutation?
A lot of the trials with the new drugs at the moment do require T790M. So I probably would have had a hard time getting her onto a trial if she was negative.
What would you have done?
In that case, I would have tried a second-line chemo. She'd really only had one chemo before the carbo-pem. Or I would have tried to get her onto an immune therapy trial if there was one available, trying a totally different approach. I think one thing we are seeing with the immune data, and we may get to this later, but smoking status may impact how patients do. And never smokers, which this patient happened to be a never smoker, they may have actually the lowest chance of response to immune therapy, at least as a single agent. So
that's really interesting. I never thought about that. Wow, that's a very good point. And well, again, as you say, we'll talk about that in a second when I get to one of your patients. This patient did have the T790 mutation. What happened?
She was able to get on a trial. The trial slot that we had for her at that time was with rosalitinib, CO1686. And so at the time of our discussion today, she's been on that drug for about 9 to 10 months now, and she's doing really well. She had a partial response, a pretty dramatic partial response already on her first scan, which has been maintained. Her breathing improved. She's been back to her very athletic self of trying to climb mountains and doing a lot of hiking and getting ready to bar mitzvah her son this year. So she's very excited. She has had some side effects, as most patients do on clinical trials. She had an elevated glucose, which we see a lot with the 1686, and we had put her on an oral hypoglycemic drug, metformin, and that took care of that symptom very well. But she's done great.
Any other tolerability issues with her?
No, she's done very, very well.
And can we talk a little bit about what we know right now about this agent from the research that really you've done and the other agents or agent that's out there kind of in the same space, so to speak?
Yeah, so the two drugs that are really the farthest along are the CO1686 rosalitinib drug and the AZD9291. There are a whole host of other ones that are coming along in various stages of phase one, so I don't think it'll be just these two for long, but so far that's what the discussion has focused around, are these two. And both drugs seem to be very active in the early phase one and phase two studies, especially in patients with T790M, which is what they're designed to do. These drugs are designed to hit both the activating mutations and the T790 mutations in EGFR, but not wild type. So, you know, with our older drugs, it's the wild type inhibition that causes the rash, the diarrhea, the nail changes, the side effects we think of as EGFR-like side effects. And so these newer drugs don't tend to cause that same wild-type cluster of symptoms. The CO1686 causes elevated insulin levels, is how I think of it, more so than glucose. Because some patients do end up getting a high glucose, but not all patients. And we're still really learning about how to manage that side effect. And do you just treat the patients who measure a high glucose, or is it something a little bit broader than that? And so we're still trying to work all those issues out. But my experience has been that in patients that are having difficulties with their glucose axis, that the oral drugs like metformin can really help with the symptoms and make this a pretty tolerable regimen. The AZD9291 has also been very active. Both drugs have a response rate of around 60%. And AZD9291, you know, I've treated several patients with that as well. It's very well tolerated. And so I think these drugs are going to make a huge impact on patients when they're hopefully FDA approved.
So this lady had no rash or diarrhea?
She had no rash. She had a little bit of diarrhea, which seemed to be more related to the metformin. You know, so we adjusted things around, and she doesn't have that anymore now. But she definitely has had no rash.
Really amazing when you think about it.
It really is.
So AZD9291 now has a name, osimertinib. I know that hyperglycemia has not been seen with this agent. Are there any tolerability issues?
I think that there have been, at some of the meetings where they've presented data, there's been some interstitial lung disease reported. I mean, a lot of the EGFR inhibitors can cause that. It's a really well-tolerated drug, the AZD. Most patients don't really have any symptoms.
And I don't know, in a weird sort of way, kind of reminds me what's happened with ALK disease in terms of crizotinib and then ceritinib and the other second generation agents, that you kind of look at the next generation that's being used after the first generation and you think, well, it seems like that ought to be up front, but maybe not. So what is the thinking right now about kind of the sequencing of these, the first and the third generation, I guess, in EGFR?
There are studies that are already open with each drug. The CO1686 is being studied against erlotinib in the frontline setting in the TIGER-1 study, and the AZD9291 is also being studied against erlotinib in the frontline, and it's called the FLORA study. And I think these will be really important randomized trials. You know, you could certainly imagine that how long you're on your first drug could be really improved with these, but it's not just the first failure that you need to think about. When you're thinking about, for example, if you were to take AZD9291 as your first drug, it would have to be at least as good as far as time that it gave you as if you had taken erlotinib first, followed by AZD9291. So it's not just beating erlotinib, in my mind. It has to beat what you would get with the sequence.
Yeah, for sure. But on the other hand, if everything turned out to be the same and you just didn't have the rash, you know, it seems like that in and of itself, you know, at least from a quality of life point of view, would be valuable. So I want to ask you about another patient that relates to the topic of EGFR mutant disease. And this is your 44-year-old lady that you first saw in 2008.
Yeah, this woman is an amazing lady who I've known for a number of years now. And she was pretty young when she was diagnosed. And the way she got diagnosed with cancer is she bought herself one of those full body scans, check out everything, make sure everything was okay. Unfortunately, there was a lung mass that was discovered. And so
she was a smoker?
She was a never smoker.
She was a never smoker. I saw that. It was so fascinating. I didn't even know people do that. So you can just write a check and get a scan?
Yeah, I've seen a couple patients that have been given these scans as a present, like a 40th or a 50th birthday present. You know, their brother gives them this, you know, I don't know how much they cost, maybe $3,000 or $4,000 CAT scan.
Wow.
They think it's a present, and then they find they have cancer. And
Oh, my gosh.
But, yeah, that's what happened here.
So she was feeling totally well.
She felt completely
non-smoker, totally well, and they pick up a lung cancer.
They picked up a lung mass, which turned out to be adenocarcinoma. And, you know, unfortunately, or maybe it was fortunate for her. I mean, maybe if she hadn't had that scan, she would have had metastatic disease. But it had already by that time spread to her mediastinal lymph nodes. So that was discovered at the time of her surgery. So after the surgery, she had 3A disease. And so she was treated with adjuvant chemotherapy, 4 cycles of cisplatin pemetrexed. Then she got sequential radiation because of the positive lymph node.
Now you managed her at that point?
She actually was managed by our common friend Tom Lynch at that point.
I see.
And she became my patient when Tom went to Yale.
So but as long as you brought it up, though, I just want to touch on, because there's so much excitement in metastatic disease, we don't talk that much about adjuvant therapy anymore. But I am curious right now how you are approaching adjuvant chemotherapy decisions, adenocarcinoma, squamous carcinoma. She had adenocarcinoma. She got cis-pem. Is that what you use nowadays?
Yeah, my favorite regimen for adjuvant patients is cis-pem if they have adeno and cis-gem if they have squamous. The taxanes, they're just very hard on patients, so I've been straying away from taxanes. And the cisnavalbine regimen that was originally studied in some of the adjuvant trials, that's a really tough regimen with getting navalbine every single week for 16 weeks.
So when did you start to get involved with her exactly?
So during all of this surgery, they did genetic testing and they found she had an EGFR mutation. So I started following her after she was done with her chemo and radiation, and she was going to enroll on a clinical study we had at that time of adjuvant erlotinib, the SELECT trial. So this was not a randomized trial. Everyone got 2 years of erlotinib. And this particular patient completed her 2 years. You know, she did have some of the common side effects that you would expect from erlotinib. She had some rash and some diarrhea, but none of it was really, I would say, interfering with her quality of life. She was active, she was working, she was traveling. And she completed the 2 years. You know, one really difficult conversation we had was at the end of the 2 years, whether it was okay to stop it because, you know, her cancer hadn't come back. She was at high risk for recurrence with her stage 3, but we talked about how there was no real data that said she should continue. And of course, there's always a chance for a significant complication with any cancer drugs. So we stopped, and now she's several years out from stopping and doing very well. Luckily, has had no evidence of disease recurrence.
What would you have estimated her risk of relapse was originally and then with chemotherapy?
Well, you know, we don't know exactly how the EGFR mutation changes the standard statistics. I mean, if we take that out of consideration, a stage 3A patient, you know, has a very high risk of relapse, above 80%, maybe even above 90%. So chances are she was going to recur. Chemotherapy can improve that by 5 to 10%. And we hope that the radiation for stage 3 can also improve that. But I think she's still, in the old teaching, not including the EGFR mutation, she probably would have still had a 75% chance of recurrence. Now, EGFR mutant patients may have just a better natural history. We've studied some of the 1A patients, you know, because now that adjuvant chemotherapy is in the mix, it's harder to study the natural history of what you get after surgery because so many people get chemo. But for stage 1A patients, we've looked at our Mass General experience, and patients with an EGFR mutation have an extremely low recurrence rate. On a 10-year follow-up, it's, you know, in the single digits. So it may be that EGFR patients have a little bit better prognosis as far as recurrence. But even so, I think she had a pretty high chance.
So this lady's case is very interesting, of course. And I think maybe we could talk a little bit about what we know right now from the trial she was on, the SELECT trial that you ran, and what other data have come out about this question of adjuvant EGFR TKIs, particularly the RADIANT trial?
Yeah, so the SELECT trial has a pretty mature follow-up, and I hope it will soon be available for people to read in a publication form. But we've talked about it at ASCO, and I think its main problem is that it's not a randomized trial. So we had 100 patients. They all had EGFR mutations. They all received 2 years of erlotinib. And the disease-free survival at 2 years was 96%. So the number of patients who recurred on treatment was very, very low. Now, once they stopped their 2 years of adjuvant erlotinib, that's when we started to see more recurrences happening. It's still a relatively low percentage. I don't have the most recent update in front of me, but the majority of patients have not recurred, the vast majority. But the ones who have recurred, they tend to happen after they're off the erlotinib, not on the erlotinib.
What fraction of the patients were able to get through the 2 years?
That's a good question because, you know, we did start the SELECT trial with the standard dose for metastatic patients at 150. And I think if I had to do the whole thing over again, I might start with the lower dose because we definitely lost a percent, probably up to 10% of the patients we lost in the first couple of months because of just the initial onset of rash. And that could have been softened, I think, with the lower dose. But the patients who stopped all tended to stop within the first couple of months, and it was about 10%. And so once patients made it through the first month or two, they tended to stay on for the whole time.
So I guess there are a couple other data sets that people have talked about when they talk about this. One is the Radiant and the other, I think it was the Memorial series. Can you talk about what we learned from those efforts and right now how you put together the whole issue of adjuvant therapy VEGFR mutant patients?
Yeah, so the Radiant study is a prospective randomized trial. The Memorial data that was published by Dr. Azzoli and Dr. Janjigian was a retrospective look. And Memorial was a close collaborator with us on the SELECT trial. But before they had the SELECT trial open, they did have some other series of different adjuvant TKI studies over the years. So they kind of combined all of these studies, smaller studies, plus some patients that were treated off protocol, and they looked retrospectively at EGFR patients who either did or didn't get adjuvant EGFR TKIs. And they saw that there was a significant PFS advantage and that they didn't have the statistical power to show a survival advantage, but it was trending in that direction. And so they published their results and they also published some calculations, back-of-the-envelope calculations for how many patients you would need to see a survival advantage based on the trends that they saw. And so Radiant was a prospective randomized trial, but it wasn't limited to EGFR mutants. It was more of the general lung cancer population. Patients after surgery and after chemo at their doctor's discretion were randomized to 2 years of erlotinib or placebo. And of course, a small percentage of the patients on that trial did have an EGFR mutation. So last year at ASCO, we saw the overall results of the trial, and we also saw how the EGFR mutation patients did. And overall, for non-small cell, there was no advantage, it looked like, with the adjuvant erlotinib. But there was an interesting and significant, I think clinically significant, disease-free survival advantage. Now, it was not statistically significant because the way the trial was written, it was very clearly stated that if the overall analysis was negative, statistically negative, you didn't have the option to look at the statistical significance of any subgroups. So even though, you know, when you apply a p-value to the numbers, it comes out as a significant p-value, the real answer is it's not a significant disease-free survival advantage for the EGFR mutants.
And I mean, even if it is, I guess the thing people really want to know is about survival and essentially the question of treating adjuvantly or waiting until relapse, which, you know, comes up in so many different kinds of cancers. Any thoughts about that question?
Yeah, well, the Radiant data was a bit immature in the survival, but it didn't look like there was going to necessarily be a survival advantage, at least from ASCO last year.
Did most of the patients in Radiant, or do we know what fraction, got erlotinib, you know, subsequently on relapse?
I don't know that they know that. They didn't necessarily capture all the treatments on relapse. You know, in the SELECT trial, we do know that. And again, it's not a randomized trial, so it's hard to draw conclusions. But my personal sense of seeing several of the patients who did have a relapse, they had extremely sensitive disease, kind of more than I would have guessed, more than I'm used to seeing in someone who just walks in the door with metastatic disease, meaning that some of these patients who recurred and had multiple lung nodules after they stopped their adjuvant or erlotinib, when they went back on the adjuvant or erlotinib, these things just melted away and stayed away for a long, long time. The anecdotal PFS with just a couple of these patients is way longer than the 9 months we tend to see in metastatic patients. So
if that's true, why do you think it is true?
It may be that we're just dealing with, you know, when the patients got the adjuvant erlotinib, they had such microscopic disease at that point. They didn't have any measurable disease on a CAT scan. So we just may be dealing with fewer clones. It may be simpler cancers. And, you know, we're suppressing them, and then we stop the adjuvant erlotinib, and they grow a little bit, but we're surveilling them very carefully. So we catch the cancers when there's maybe fewer clonal populations. I don't know the answer yet, but it's pretty striking how different they seem to be responding.
So do you have any sense right now in terms of, and well, maybe the best way to ask you this question, which is, you know, whether long-term people would do better if they got adjuvant therapy. If this 44-year-old lady were to show up today and she were not eligible to go into a trial, what would you do?
If she were not eligible to go into a trial, I think I would think pretty seriously about giving her some adjuvant EGFR TKI. And if it was me, knowing what I know, I would probably take some. You know, I think we're going to have better answers. There's an ongoing cooperative group trial, the Alchemist trial, that hopefully will help give us some answers. Or they're specifically looking at EGFR mutation patients and randomizing them against placebo. So I think some of these questions will be better answered by that trial.
It's interesting. I think anybody who's listened to the last 10 minutes of this conversation would kind of come to that conclusion when you kind of listen to the whole story and all the data. And yet, what you just said is probably, I think you're in the minority in terms of clinical investigators right now. I think people are still, there's concern that potentially there could be a negative impact. You know, people cite, I think it was a SWOG study in the past where they saw a negative impact.
You're right. I am in the minority. That is,
and I'm not true. Saying you're wrong. And I always like to ask people what they would do of themselves. But, you know, even more of an issue is, again, and this, you know, I keep thinking about rituximab and, you know, follicular lymphoma, where they showed, yeah, it is a great drug, but, you know, you do just as well if you give it later. And that, to me, it kind of looks like people wouldn't do as well, but it's hard to argue it, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. And there's really no evidence basis to give it. I can't argue with that. But at the same time, I probably would.
And, you know, I mean, it could have a harmful effect. You know, I was thinking about, we did a national survey of oncologists in February 2005. And we presented, like, I think it was a 42-year-old woman with HER2-positive breast cancer and 5 positive nodes. And if you remember, it was 3 months later that the data came out. But at that point, nobody had any idea. And virtually no docs in practice and no investigators would use trastuzumab.
Wow.
I mean, they really held the line. And then, you know, the second the data came out, they changed. And then everybody was like, wow, we should have realized that. But it's just so difficult in oncology, you know, to figure out what to do.
You know, that year at ASCO, I remember I was at the airport with one of my colleagues who's a breast cancer doctor, and we were waiting to go back to Boston. And while we were waiting there for maybe half an hour, she literally got 6 phone calls from patients who had heard the news and wanted to know if they should be getting trastuzumab. It was
right,
unbelievable.
Yeah, it was really an amazing moment in oncology. One final question, getting back to the issue of targetable mutations. I'm curious what your take is in terms of the issue of HER2 mutations and also BRAF mutations in non-small cell lung cancer. How often do you see these? What do they mean? Do they respond to targeted therapy?
I think that if you test patients, if you test a large group of patients in your practice, you will pick these up. You know, these are the 1-2% pieces of the pie. There's, you know, BRAF mutations, HER2 mutations, and then a separate piece of the pie is HER2 amplification. And then there's MET amplification also. So these are all things that at our center, we try and test everybody for broad panels, but especially or if I'm seeing a consult of someone who's been tested for EGFR, ALK, KRAS, maybe ROS, and is negative for all of those things, I would consider testing this sort of next level of mutations because you will see them in 1 or 2% of the people who you send. And I've treated several patients with HER2 abnormalities. You know, the BRAF abnormalities, just like in some of the other cancers, come in a couple different flavors. And the V600E BRAF mutations are the ones that seem to respond to the, or have the potential to respond best to the BRAF TKIs. It's been just my luck that all my BRAF mutation patients that I've uncovered have not been V600E. BRAF, but rather other BRAF mutants. But I have treated a couple of HER2-amplified patients with trastuzumab plus chemo, often navalbine, because that's a regimen with a lot of safety data from breast cancer. And I think that HER2 amplification patients, you know, I think of them a little bit more like breast cancer type of regimens for HER2 amplification. The HER2 mutation in lung cancer patients, and there's some data looking at some of the EGFR, the second generation drugs like afatinib or dacomitinib, which isn't approved at this time, but there have been trials looking at pan-HER TKIs for patients with HER2 mutations that have shown some anecdotal activity. And, you know, I think structurally, actually, the HER2 mutations are very similar to something we talked about earlier, which is the EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations. So, you know, if we find something that can work for one of those two, it may work pretty well for the other one, because structurally, those two mutations are pretty similar.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've heard this thing about that maybe the people with the mutations might respond better to a TKI. So, for example, would you use or have you used afatinib in a patient with a HER2 mutation?
I've used dacomitinib on a clinical trial, and, you know, I got mediocre results. I know there have been some other colleagues of mine that have seen really good results. But I think that our panel of what we want to test for is only going to keep getting bigger, so we just have to figure out a way to economically test people for all these different mutations.